Hello, welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, RTFM, read the fucking manual. This is the longer, deeper dive, the fuller, thicker experience, ribbed for her pleasure. I'm joined today by my co-host, Fintan Costello. Fintan, hello.
Jesus Christ.
I'm John Bruford, your host. We are also joined today by Sean Bowen of Push Technology. Sean, I went to school with Adam Bowen. Are you related to him?
Not that I'm aware of, John, and thanks for having us on. I'm not sure how to follow up after that intro, though. So
where are you calling from today? Where are you based?
I'm based in Austin, Texas now, so no longer in the UK.
That is interesting. This is an interesting stat about Austin, Texas. It's the capital of midget porn, which I'm sure is just a coincidence.
Well, I can safely say that was not the first reason we moved here, but it's interesting to know that. Oh, my God. Yeah.
It was the ribs and then the midget porn, right? That was the barbecue. And then, right. Sean, let's just pretend John's not here and let's crack on.
That sounds like a plan.
In the shorter episode, you talked about that it's very much a startup, but you've obviously been doing this for 15, 16 years with Push Technology.
Yes.
And I think that's really interesting. And then what also jumped out at me was you were talking about empowering the team. Now, a lot of managers say that, but in my experience, I saw you've got, you were in the Air Force.
Yep.
So all the best managers I've ever had have served in the Air Force or Army. Can you just talk a little bit to, you know, a 15-year startup, and I love that mentality, plus the Air Force experience. And is there like a things you learned in the Air Force carry over to business, or is that just something Jocko Willink says to some folks?
Yeah, like, I think there's things you learn in every aspect of your life if your eyes are open, right? So even before I got to the Air Force, you know, I came from a humbling background. I had to go to work at 14, and I worked in the retail space. And, you know, that gave me an angle that, you know, the customer is almost always right. And we need to make sure as a software company, we are delivering the kind of service that customers want to talk about. So, you know, I learned from that. I think the Air Force was, if I'm honest, it was a chance for me to get my life on track. And I didn't want to go back to college. I'd kind of thrown it away playing soccer or football. Sorry, I'm there in the UK here. But I wanted to get my career back on track, and I didn't want to go back to school. And I think what really did it is when my mum said to me one day, "You'll never follow through with this." And I'm one of those people that if you tell me I can't do something, I will absolutely do it. And I signed up to the Air Force. I joined. If anyone wants to put a child through something where it puts them on the straight and narrow and teaches them to fight for everything, I recommend the forces. You know, basic training is a lot of fun. When you get through the tough parts, you certainly come out of it a lot stronger. I think it absolutely transformed my work ethic, and I think that's sort of kind of set me up in good stead for being a founding CEO, because it's definitely not a 9-to-5 job, right? So I think it helps with that. Respect, I think, is the key one I got from the Air Force. I remember when I was doing my passing out parade, and my parents said to me, "Wow, where's my son gone? You've got manners now, right?" And I think everyone that works with you and you engage with, you need to show respect. I treat everyone, hopefully, exactly the same way. And I think that goes a long way to building some culture. Now, that doesn't mean that if people aren't doing their job, you have to jump on them. But I think if you've got clear communication, respect, and trust, they're good kind of building blocks to build the rest on. And I think that's what I kind of got out of the Air Force, if I'm honest. So, yeah, it was a great experience. And as much as I love it, I still wouldn't let my kids do it, I don't think. too many wars today. So I was quite lucky. I timed it in between the first and second Gulf War. So
nice.
Perfect timing.
And I think I have to agree with that. I think clear communication has been the that's how I would describe any of my previous managers who've been in the forces. It was just very, you really understood what the task was and what success looked like. There was no ambiguity around that. And that really, I really respond well to that. So that's really interesting. So look, it's a 15-year startup. Obviously, there's highs and lows, and I think from my experience in the startup world, it's the highs are very high and the lows are very low. And people only see the highs, right? So you don't see that. So what kind of journey have you guys been on, or have you been on and with the team over the last 15 years to, like, looking through the roster of brands on your website, you've pretty much got the gambling industry sewn up, for example. That didn't happen by mistake. Can you talk a bit to that?
No, and it was interesting you say the highs and lows, because this is one advice I give to my sales team as well, even the youngsters we bring on. I think the first couple of years, I was probably quite emotional with such big highs and such big lows, right? And in fact, the bigger the high, the lower the low that normally follows, right? Because you're starting from a much higher peak. So the one thing I've learned and the one thing I teach the team is don't get too excited with the wins. And then you won't get too disappointed with the losses. And you don't win every deal. It just never happens, right? No one's that lucky. So I think that was a key learning for me that I've passed on to the team. But you're right, you know, it didn't happen overnight. We had to do some creative deals with some customers, and we had to have a strong product, and we had to have a little bit of luck. Anyone that says there's no luck in a startup, I think is lying. So, you know, timing is a big, big thing in my world. Right? Having the right product at the right time is key. And, you know, I put that down to fortune sometimes.
It's better to be lucky than good sometimes. I totally agree with that. And I've experienced and I've seen it happen where you're too early or you're too late, and there is that sweet spot. So
we were way too early. Right. So what we've had to do for those years is keep the lights on until the time was right for the rest of the industry to catch up. And that's exactly what's happening now. Yeah. The world has completely changed, and it's now all very much event driven. And we can thank products like Apache that have come along and that are everywhere, and our stream processing, some of the UI technologies now that have come along that are all event driven. And it's enabling customers to now look at how could I change my product to be more real time? And that's why, you know, it isn't just gaming and finance that we get pulled into now. I think early on, it was absolutely just gaming and finance. Speed didn't really matter to anyone else. Real-time data wasn't really important back then. So, yeah, it's an interesting that you say, you know, coming along at the right time. And that was the challenge for the first probably 10, 12 years. We had some great customers, but there was only a small pond to go fishing in.
Got it. And so it's that classic overnight success that's been chugging away for 12 years to get there. I love it.
Exactly.
So looking through the case studies, you've got three names that jump out to me. So I come from the affiliate space as well. So Sports Predictor, Odds Checker, and Racing Post are three heavyweights in completely different. Obviously, Sports Predictor is very Australia focused, and then Odds Checker is Odds Checker and Racing Post. Anyone in the UK knows exactly who they are. All three of them. And I saw one of your things was called data wrangling, which I thought was just a brilliant way to put it. But anybody who's dealt with a bookmaker's odds feed or multiple bookmakers' odds feed will completely get the phrase wrangling, because how they all do things is different. Typos, naming conventions, mistake, just general mistakes, messing around, whatever. So processing, like if you look at what Odds Checker do, like the amount of effort I'm guessing they have to put into just managing feeds, let alone doing the kind of, that is the day job in effect. Like, how do you support that? How do you enable that?
Yeah, no, good question. So, you know, when we first came along, delivery was the number one focus, and that's what we did because people were failing to get real-time data out. But we soon realized that, especially in gaming, you have so many peak events throughout the year, you have very little windows to actually build anything and deploy it. And, one of the biggest complaints I hear from sportsbook providers is I don't know where to find a feed. And when I do get it, it's a nightmare to integrate. So wrangling just become a hot subject for us. And we realized that if we could build a low code platform with very simple syntax language for completely being able to transform messages that are in flight into new structures, you know, whether you're just filtering, merging, conflating, etc., just being able to transform it in flight very simply, it would be a big win for the customers. And we were looking at what the customers were doing today, and there was a load of bespoke code which A, is heavy and time consuming to build, but then it's also a risk. Yeah, it's a risk if you have an outage because something changes. So having something like, you know, our platform, which is fully tested, robust, can scale, perform, and you can see the impact of the changes you're making in a UI, we thought was going to be a, you know, a big win for that customer base. So the integration was one part, but it went further than that with us. And we started to build some other great features, which are not so highlighted yet, but hopefully they will. And we're just about to do a great webinar coming up on personalization. But, you know, that's another thing I keep hearing in the gaming market is, you know, for such an innovative market, no one's really nailed personalization for a customer experience. And for us, it started with the wrangling. If we can take these big feeds from the data providers, break them apart into millions of different topics, right? And then I can start to package that back up and tie it to the profile of the person that's connecting in. So obviously you've got to subscribe in for me to give you something personal. If you're just an anonymous user, then we'll just give you the default standard. But I can now start to look at what you're interested in and tailor what you see. And also look at what you're doing in real time, what you're clicking, what you're interested in, and changing again what gets presented in front of you. So I think that wrangling plays a big part in that personalization piece as well. And then last but not least, I mean, as you heard, I'm over here in America, and you know, new states are opening up, and you know, controlling what data goes where. You don't want that to be a heavy job again. You want it to be able, you want to be able to turn these feeds on quickly for a new territory and get first mover advantage. So, you know, that whole wrangling piece plays a part in that as well. As well as the reverse, by the way, when a territory gets shut down, how quickly you can turn it off so you don't get a fine from the regulators. So wrangling to me is a crown jewels that no one really knows about that really is unique to our platform.
I used to be a China wrangler. No, it's true story.
Government.
Well, I and this is not long ago, but I used to help a guy out on the local market because he had boxes and boxes of China, and he was a bit older than me. I hope he's listening because that would be hilarious. And yeah, it was just like lugging huge boxes of China. It's quite a physical thing. And then I help him pack up at the end of the day. I only stopped doing it a couple of years ago because I like to stay buff. Do you know what I mean? And so the one day I just turned to him and I said, it's a young man's game, China wrangling. And, you know, you guys talking about wrangling, it's just brought it all back. It's like I'm out there now lugging boxes.
The crazy thing is I can't tell if he's serious or joking because it's entirely possible this is actually a true story.
This is a true story.
What was his name? What market was it? What was your shift times? Come on, I need details.
Ludlow Market, and I'd be there about 8:30 to help him out for an hour, and then again about 4 o'clock to help him close up for an hour. And yeah, it was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it. His name was Richard, but I can't remember his surname because I just called him Rich the Croc.
Okay. So Sean, look, so gathering all the data is one thing. So if you go back to personalization for a second, you know, you're gathering all the data, you got all the click data, you got all this kind of stuff. Having sat on the receiving end of that, it then becomes, okay, so I've got all this data and it's kind of overwhelming in terms of, well, how do I make decisions? How do I do stuff with this? How do I drive that personalization? Does that work?
Well, we wouldn't make those decisions for you. You're going to need some kind of AI, machine learning type thing to plug in the middle of this. But what we do is we make sure that when you log in under your credentials, we know who's logging in, and we've set up a profile for you on the back end. And what you don't want to do as a gaming company is have to build a bunch of bespoke code to manage different topics that are getting presented or different types of groupings of data that get presented. You want to manage that on the back end because otherwise it makes your client so heavy. So in our world, if we can break all this data apart and we can understand what you're looking at and pass that into some kind of AI machine learning product, it can tell us what we should be presenting back to you. And we can do it in a way that you can, you know, you don't have to write all that custom code on the front end, right? We can do it in a very lightweight way because we manage all this from the back end. We manage what you're subscribed to, what you're not subscribed to. And we just launched a site called Session Trees. And it gives us that power on the front end to say, look, you subscribe to this topic, which could be my profile. Mm-hmm. And behind the scenes, it goes and works out every topic we need to subscribe you to for that subscription. You know, that's a very basic example, but that just takes away a lot of that complexity that you'd have to put into your client. So you still need to plug in some logic to say, what do I want to show them? But it's all real time. I'm telling you what I'm interested in real time. You're making the assumptions on the back end and then, you know, telling me what to present back. And that all happens through our security.
Got it. So because I think, like, you know, personalization has been on everybody's roadmap for, you know, years. Like there's slide decks dying in drawers in operators' offices right now with personalization, homepage personalization or something on their plan. And it never seems to come to life. So who's doing a great job at this?
Well, we haven't seen anyone doing it in gaming yet. And the reason this came up, you mentioned Odds Checker, right? So I was fortunate enough that a lot of the customers we've sold to, I've become, you know, good friends with a number of them over the years. And I was actually catching up with Darren Maggs, who was the MD of Odds Checker back then. And we were talking about some of the technology we were bringing to market. And he just said to me at the time, he said, wow, he said, look, personalization, sorry, that he doesn't believe anyone's done right yet. And I was telling him what we were launching and how it could be used for exactly that use case. So this is something like we're just bringing to market. Like I say, we're just about to launch a webinar on it, showing how you would do it with a product like ours. So I'm hoping, you know, one of the customers picks it up and says, look, this is a great idea. Let's get going. And we can change that from no one being able to do it properly to everyone doing it properly, right? With little effort.
And if we go, obviously, if we go outside of the gaming industry, then is there anybody you can point at and say, look, the obvious one is like the Amazon homepage or the Facebook feed, but that's too obvious. Is there any real companies doing it? Because I don't consider them real anymore.
Netflix have been doing it for years, right? Whether you like what they promote in front of you, but these companies have been doing it for a long time. So, you know, they seem to track what you're doing and try and present similar like products back to you or films. So, I think the streaming video services are probably the ones I see doing it the best. Let's put it that way.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. And where, so when we look at data, there's huge money being spent in the particularly in the US market on, say, like the NFL data feed went for massive amount of money.
That was obscene, wasn't it?
And rightly so, I would argue. So obviously data is a commodity, or certainly not a commodity, like it's a highly valuable resource, and it's becoming scarcer and scarcer. You provide a lot of the technology to pull in all these different data feeds from your sport radars and your I'm struggling to think of the other names, but all the different companies that these major aggregators or rights providers, rights owners.
Yep.
And where do you see the industry going? Is there just more consolidation? So there's be two or three major providers that are going to consolidate everything, or there'll be more fragmentation, or how do you see all that progressing over time?
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously I come from a financial services background, and I looked what happened there with the Reuters and everyone else around data, right? You feel something's got to happen because it is fragmented and there's different ways of integrating it in, and there's not much flexibility in it. This is what I like to think we're bringing to some of our customers. And, you know, I'll shout out one that we signed at the beginning of the year, Angstrom Sports, who are looking to deliver real-time data, real-time sports data feeds. And it's probably worth saying a lot of the ones that are out there are not real-time. They're polling, right? So there is a delay, and that has its own inherent impact on the data providers themselves, because it comes with a requirement for a lot of infrastructure to support that kind of service. So putting in a product like ours reduces their footprint on infrastructure and then hopefully speeds up their feeds. But the one thing I like to think we've brought to customers like Angstrom and others out there is this ability to really break down the data into such small chunks of data that the customer can choose exactly what bit it wants to subscribe to or not. Otherwise, you're getting forced to consume massive amounts of data that you don't always need. Yeah. So I think that's one of the changes we're looking to drive into that market. But you're absolutely right on the, you know, will it consolidate? I can see that happening. It's exactly what happened in the financial services market. It happens in most markets, right?
As soon as you end up with a Bloomberg and a Reuters, and then that's basically exactly it, right? That's your your data. And even then, it's you know, it's 90% Bloomberg and whatever Reuters.
Exactly. Now, what we've done, by the way, is I've said to a bunch of my sportsbook customers today, look, you know, we want to help, because, you know, selfishly, if you're using our platform to get data in, you'll use it for delivery, right? So, you know, I'm not just doing it out of the goodness of my heart, but I do realize that it is difficult to integrate into a lot of these back-end data feeds. And they're not very efficient. And that's where, you know, I mentioned earlier, we do something very, very different. Now, we move data like video, right? And what I mean by that is we're not like a traditional messaging product. I kind of give an analogy that a traditional messaging product is like your postman, yeah? You hope they always deliver your message. There's no guarantee there. But they always deliver your mail, but they never look inside it, right? Yeah, and you're probably thinking, why would you ever want to look inside it? Well, look, if I look at the data, I can work out whether I need to send all of it to you or just part of it. And that's how we work. We work like video. And if you think about video, the very first frame you get is every pixel to draw the picture. And the second frame you get is the delta. We don't send every pixel again. We only send the pixels to convert one picture to another. Yeah. And when we did that, we realized that we were saving, the majority of my gaming companies have seen a 99% reduction in data transfer. Right, which is huge, especially when some of these are sitting in tax havens for obvious reasons, and the cost of moving data is so expensive because there's just one telco on the island, right? But even if you're in the cloud, it's still not cheap to move such big amounts of data. And we've said for years, you know, there's been this buzz around big data. Gaming companies have been doing big data for years. You have a lot of markets moving a lot of real-time data all over the globe, and you know, driving down the cost of getting it out of a cloud or getting it out of a tax haven has been a key, you know, differentiator with us. And when you're moving all this data as a data provider, you know, that's also important. And then there's always a knock-on effect as well. I kind of always give this analogy, another one where, you know, because we're running over the internet, it's a shared network, not a dedicated network like we would have inside our corporate firewalls. And the trouble with a shared network is it fluctuates on bandwidth, on usage. And then also, if I'm connecting via mobile, I might get random disconnects, right? And I want to deliver the best possible experience over that. Now, for the fluctuating data when it's congested, again, if you're taking a 50K message and stripping it down to 1K or a few hundred bytes, it's like the difference between a 10-ton truck and a motorcycle trying to enter a busy motorway, right? If the gap's not big enough for that truck, you're sitting there waiting, whereas the motorcycle's nipping into the smallest of gaps. So having a product like this means you always move your data quickly, even when it's difficult conditions. And I think that's also another thing that's quite compelling, not just for the data providers, but the sportbook providers, right?
Of course.
How do I make sure I deliver the best possible experience? Because what I don't want at the end of the day is an unmatched bet, right? Because I couldn't move the price quick enough.
And I'm assuming it works on the other side as well. So in terms of the delay, so you've obviously got a latency between, say, the tennis serve or the goal being scored versus it being reflected in the data. So the quicker that is, and it's a bit like your high frequency trading type stuff. So the quicker that is, the quicker it's reflected in the odds, and then the bookie's not going to get picked off by a sharp punter who's got somebody sitting in the stands. Exactly. Less likely to happen anyway.
I could be wrong. We were either number one or number two. I think we were number one, but one of our customers, I think, were the first to bring point by point betting to a mobile app, right? In play because of our technology. Now, it's not all down to us. You have to have very fast algorithms to work out what the prices are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we then were able to distribute it out as quickly as possible, even in difficult markets, difficult conditions.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, if we look at the way in-play betting is betting these days, and it's going to become even bigger, particularly in places like America, where that's going to get even more important. That's fantastic. John?
He's not off moving from China, are you?
Do you know what? When you're experienced at that kind of thing, it doesn't take very long. when you've
it's all in the knees,
muscle already.
There you go.
No, I was just being quiet because I was appreciating that you were nerding out. I was interviewing Sean last week for something else.
It's not a rival podcast, is it? Is this where you're breaking up with me? Is this how I find out?
No, it's not a rival. It's a compliment.
Oh, Jesus Christ. You told me you loved me, John.
Did I, though?
I got to say, though, Fintan, there was no mention of midget porn on that one, though.
Was there? Right? Ooh, corporate John.
there were other people.
Sellout.
Do you know, I nearly shared a story just then that might have got me in trouble, and I just managed to rein it in. So, no, what I was going to ask you, when I was interviewing you last week, Sean, we got to the Super Bowl outage tale, and I actually made some notes to ask you more about that, and then I didn't.
Yep.
So tell me about what year was the Super Bowl outage, what happened, why did it happen, and how did you not end up with egg or something worse on your face?
Well, it happened last year, right? It's every year, the Super Bowl. But last year there was an outage.
Fucking Super Bowl happens every year. When did the outage happen?
Well, it's on the day of the Super Bowl. And I don't know what time they were doing on this one, but I see these reports every year, right? Every year during Super Bowl, a number of the larger and probably some of the smaller sportsbook providers have outages. And like I said, that's why I remember back to that I think I mentioned to you earlier, Darren getting up at one of our golf events claiming they were the biggest bookmaker because they took 23 bookmakers' feeds and put it on one site, which is what Oddschecker do, and how since he's put Diffusion in, he has no one on site, one person on call, it just works. Look, we've nailed this for years, and the key is back to that data message I was giving you earlier, right? The kind of limiting factor I always see is there's only one pipe in and out of a building, but you can put many bits of infrastructure inside that building. But if you start hitting the limit of how much data you're trying to move, that's when it starts to struggle. And then the back end starts to struggle as well, especially if they start scaling up so quickly. And Fintan mentioned how quickly, Grand National grows. Well, imagine Super Bowl in America, right? Way bigger audience, and everyone is crazy for the game. So I can imagine the numbers are just, obscene. So being able to remove a lot of the unwanted data that needs to be sent out or moved, being able to be more efficient on the back end and being able to handle big spikes is something we designed the product from day one. And that's why I said a lot of people took the easy route. They just followed traditional messaging paradigms. And that's great when you're on a dedicated network and it doesn't fluctuate much, it's consistent, but that isn't the world of sportsbook. It fluctuates often, and Grand National and Champions League and things like Super Bowl, it goes through massive spikes. So you do need to have a different approach. And it's those kind of events, which, like I say, are great. And I read a press release this year mentioning the four that had outages. And it was great knowing that we didn't even get a phone call from anyone. We never do get a phone call. I think Boxing Day is another big day for the UK, right? We always get, and I never have any calls, touch wood, from any of our customers.
Is that because you turn your phone off?
Yeah, that as well. No one likes to dial overseas anymore, right? but I think that's the testament to what we've built. We built it knowing that it's going to be a disconnected network, a fluctuating network, and therefore it has a different, architecture behind it. And everyone else followed the traditional route, which is easier to build, but it doesn't work in those environments. And I think that's why peak events really showcase our product off well.
Well, I mean, gaming as an industry has both land-based and online, both have the old "if it ain't broke, don't fix it" thing. But this is a prime example of, hey, it's broke. Does an event like that benefit you afterwards? Do you get people coming and knocking on your door saying, listen, you got to turn your phone back on, we need you?
I wish it did, but people just think they can throw more infrastructure at it and it solves, right? No one likes to hear their baby's ugly either. So if they've gone and built this platform and it's worked from, most of the time, and they've seen amazing growth, even those outages, they try and, find an easier solution than is let's replace what you've got. Yeah. And I think that that's one of the other reasons we did the whole wrangling piece, right? People don't want to go through a heavy lift and shift kind of thing with their back end. And so we were like, no, you don't have to replace a load of code now. Right, you don't have to write a load of integrations into us. We're doing it all for you. And I didn't finish on the message earlier when I was talking about the integration piece. But one of the things we've said to a bunch of our customers now, especially startups, is look, don't worry about building the integration to it. We'll do it for you. They're like, what? I said, I'll build the adapter if I think it's an adapter that's going to be used by more than a few customers. And I'll take that pain on for you. And therefore, you don't have to worry about integrating these feeds in, because if I can make that bit easier as well, these big vendors, when they want to move and they don't want to have to go through that heavy lift and shift, they can know that they can just hook one of our adapters into, I think you mentioned Sport Radar earlier, yeah, or Bet Radar, or Angstrom Sports, one of our ones. if that's already done out of the box, it takes some of that pain away from that moving to a platform like us. So that we chase, whenever we see those outages, we chase them down and we highlight the fact that like, William Hill Caesars, for example, didn't have an outage, yeah. And we definitely try and get in on those platforms, but it takes time. People don't move straight away. As I said, they've got a roadmap of things to build and limited windows to go build it in. So we hope over time we bring some of those larger players over to our platform. And we're certainly in discussions with a few of them. So
if you're dealing with a lot of proprietary platforms, if you're dealing with a lot of proprietary code and stuff like that, are there obstacles to you being able to do this easily? Or is it a piece of piss for all of them?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't say it's easy, but we've architected our product right from day one. And we've just launched a product earlier this year called a gateway. And one of the things we wanted to do with it was build a framework into it where if you want to build an adapter, you follow our framework. So we do a lot of the heavy lifting up front for you. It makes it very easy to build an integration. And if it's easy for you, it's also easy for us, right? If we've got these building blocks in place. And the other like knock-on effect it did for us, it meant that if you go build an adapter or one of your partners builds an adapter for you, they can see it running inside our environment. They can stop and start it. They know how it's performing. You don't have to code all that. It's all built for you out of the box. So I think we've done a lot of the heavy lifting to make building integrations really simple. And then I think add to that the wrangling piece just makes it so much more powerful, because now you not only can integrate and get the data in, you can change it very quickly and easily to a format that is valuable to you, that you can then go and deliver out somewhere. So I think we've done a lot of the heavy work, which makes building those integrations simple now. But it certainly wasn't a simple job to get to this point, if that makes sense.
Yes, I believe it does. Fintan, do you have any further questions?
I think we've exhausted this topic in a great way.
I certainly feel spent, but that's not just because of the talk of wrangling taking me back to my China wrangling days, although that is a factor. Sean, thank you very, very much for joining us.
No, thank you for having us.
And ladies and gentlemen, Sean Bowen.
Crowd go wild. Ooh, 9 million downloads. Just like that. Sean, you took a very technical topic and made it highly engaging. That is an absolute skill. So well done for that. Thank you.
And we move on to our second guest of the RTFM episode of the Gambling Files podcast. Fintan and I are joined by Richard Marcus. Richard, I don't even know where to begin with introducing you, Richard. I think you've had quite a colorful life and career. Richard, welcome.
It's great to be with you guys.
I'm glad that you have such a low bar for happiness. You're in the right place. now, Richard, we do need to, I mean, do we, Fintan, should we assume that people listen to the TLDR episode?
I think we should. I think we should. And if they haven't, they can go listen to it afterwards.
So, because that's where Richard was talking all about his exciting new table games protection and conference in Las Vegas next year in February.
And we'll put the links in the notes afterwards as well, so everyone can find that.
Richard, just a quick reminder: what is the name of the event in Vegas?
The Global Game Protection and Table Games Conference.
And where is it?
in Las Vegas at the Excalibur Hotel Casino, February 14th through February 17th, 2022.
Sweet. Thank you very much. So, Richard.
I look, I'm literally quivering with excitement and questions. So, Richard, is it fair to say poacher turned gamekeeper is a good description of where you're at in life right now?
Absolutely. Couldn't have made that up better myself.
Right. I love poacher stories, right? So the gamekeeping bit's fine. You're teaching people how to do their jobs and your conferences, obviously, that's where you need to be to learn and improve and do all that kind of stuff.
But the poacher stuff is what everybody wants to hear. That's what we want. Everybody digs. Absolutely.
So look, we had a great chat before we even started recording. We had to stop because all the great stuff was being left on the cutting room floor. I don't think you need much prompting. Just give us a great story, mate. What have you got? Go for it.
You know what? Since you guys are from the UK, one of the funniest things that ever happened to me was in London back in the late 70s. The first time I went to London on a casino cheating trip, I was not aware. There was four of us, and we were not aware that in order to get into a London casino at the time, you had to be a member or you had to be signed into a member. It's not like in the United States or in most of the world, or I should say outside of Europe, where casinos are just like walking into a department store. You know, there's no ID check or anything like that. But since London casinos were private clubs, they had that rule. And we invested all this money to get there, right? You know, we're talking like, you know, $10,000 just for plane fares and hotel rooms. And now we get there and I go to the first casino and I get stopped at the reception desk and they say, sir, are you a member? And I say, no. And I say, sorry, you can't come in the casino. You have to join or a member has to sign you in. So now we had a big problem. You know, what are we going to do? $10,000 and now we're stuck. You know, what are we going to do? Just go fly down to the south of France and hit Monaco and Cannes and all that? Well, so, you know, we're sitting there thinking, what are we going to do? Because we don't know anybody in London. So, you know, I can't call up John or Fenton and say, hey, dude, can you get me and my buddies into a casino so we can cheat them? You know, it was not going to work. So we're like pretty desperate. And then finally, an idea came to my head because maybe 10 years before or 15 years before, I heard somebody say, you know, cab drivers are almost like hookers. They'll do anything for money. Okay. I heard, and for some reason that came into my head. Now I have nothing. I'm not saying that cab drivers are like hookers or this or that. But
I've
you know,
been doing it wrong all these years.
But maybe, you know, maybe they hustle a bit, right? They hustle up fares and stuff like that. So I swear I remembered that. You know, cab drivers are like hookers. They'll do almost anything for money. So next thing, I find myself, you know, sitting, you know, standing on a street corner waiting for the big black cabs going by. And I stop them and I say, I get in the cab. And I say, you know, just take me, you know, I just gave him a name of a place for a 3-minute ride. And I said, hey, I got a proposition for you. If I give you 500 quid, would you join a casino for me and sign me and my buddies in? You know, we're here. We want to have a good time gambling. And, you know, we just need somebody to sign us in. So, you know, like the first two or three guys, like, just threw me out of the cab, you know, like, get the hell out of here. What is this shit? What kind of scam is this, right? And, you know, we just kept trying and like 10 or 15 cabs later, you know, we're about ready to give up because, you know, people just thought I was crazy. And, you know, most people think something's up because something was up and they don't want to get involved. But finally, again, we were on the verge of packing it in and going to France. And then a black cab comes around the corner and by this time I'm not even getting in the cab anymore. You know, I just flag the guy down and I say, hey, look, I got a proposition for you. You know, interested or not? And I was holding the money. I was holding the 500 quid right at the window. All right. You know, that was a little dangerous, but I mean, not that the guy was going to swipe the money, but just like, you know, somebody might call the bobbies or the cops or whatever. But at this point, I decided to try anything. So finally, this big guy, and I mean big, you know, he was sitting down. I could see he was like, you know, 6 feet two, and what's a stone is 14 pounds, right? So like 20 stone, 280 pounds. And this guy was gigantic. And I go to him, listen, I got a little proposition. We need to get somebody to become a member of three casinos. Would you be interested in becoming a member and signing us in? And I'll give you the 500 quid. And he goes, mate, you're going to give me 500 quid? You know, I can't do English accent real well. But he's going, you're going to give me 500 quid just to join a bloody casino? I said, you got it, right? So I gave him the 500 quid. All of us piled in his cab. We went to a coffee shop, and we started to talk, and everything was cool. But the only problem was, you know, the guy didn't have any clothes. He said, we already knew that, you know, London casinos are not like Vegas casinos where you can just walk in a T-shirt and a pair of cut-off jeans, and you have to be presentable, right? So I asked the guy, you don't have any clothes? You don't have a suit? You don't have anything? He goes, no. And I looked at him. And this guy, when I looked, sitting in person, he was more than 20 stone. I mean, this guy was huge, right? So finally, I had to make a decision. We already gave him 500 pounds. So how much more is it going to cost to get this guy a suit? Because you had to have the suit handmade. So sure enough, we went to a few shops. It ended up costing us like another 300 or 400 quid to get the guy a suit. So we get the guy a suit. And now it's time for him to go join the casinos. Now, you got to remember that the British are the sharpest in the world when it comes to picking up on casino cheats and scams. The reason for that is it goes back to their duplicity days during Operation Overlord. That was the D-Day invasion of Normandy. And it's without the British were so talented in duping people, the Nazis. They were able to, you know, fill the Nazis' heads up with ideas of where the landing was going to take place. And they're just great double talk and duplicity. And that translates to on the other side when they're, you know, like protecting their casinos, they just catch on to scams and cheating and stuff like that very quickly. So the way it worked is that the member goes into the casino. The person that's going to become a member, he goes into the casino at the reception desk, and he just simply fills out an application, and they let him know. And 48 hours, he's got to come back. And if he's accepted, he gets his membership card. If he's not, he doesn't, and that's the end of it. But we knew the guy would get accepted because he had no record and he had no gambling history, so we figured it was okay. So we go back 48 hours later, because you know it's like a cooling off period. That's why they make you wait 48 hours. You know, for problem gambling and all that stuff. So anyway, we go back. He goes in the casino, and he gets approved for all three casinos. And so now he has membership to all three casinos. So now we're really excited because we're planning big stuff. You know, we're planning roulette pass post moves that are, you know, going to get $10,000 or $20,000 each shot. Pounds. And at the time, a pound was worth $2.40. So these were huge, huge moves. So we didn't tell the cabbie, you know, before we went to the first casino the night we went, we didn't tell him anything about what we're doing. We just said, look, you're going to go in the casino and you're going to sign us in as your guests. Now, guests did not have to show ID. What you're going to do, what you're going to do when we go into the casino is I'm going to give you another 100 pounds. You just get lost and have a good time. Don't bother us. You just stay away from us. And when we're ready to go, we'll tell you. Because when the member leaves, his three guests have to leave with him. So you just hang around, play roulette, do whatever you want. But just don't talk to us, and we'll come and get you when we're done. So, and I said, you know, you got that? He goes, yeah, mate, I got it. No problem. And he said, do I get a hundred quid every time we go into a casino? I said, you get it every time. Just don't bother us. So we go into the casino, the first casino, right? I'm not going to mention casino names. We go into the first casino, and everything works like, pardon the pun, everything works like roulette. We did this roulette move. And it was a huge move. We got paid. We got to 10,000 pounds and everything was cool. There was no heat, no steam, no suspicion, nothing. It worked out great. I go over, we cash out. I go over to the cabbie, who really looked funny, you know, in this suit. I mean, it didn't quite look that good, but at least it was a suit. And I said, okay, we're done here. We're going to the next casino, right? We go to the next casino. And, you know, this is like 2 hours after we'd gone into the first one. And it's the same thing. I give him 100 pounds before we go in. He signs us in, you know, we all we had to do was sign names. Like I still remember to this name, to this day, I was Roberto Martinez. That's the name I signed, right? So we went in. And we did the same thing. We did another $10,000 move. No problem. Got paid. No heat. Nobody was suspicious. And these are very difficult moves to do because, like I said before, the UK people are so sharp. If your listeners want to see like the mechanics of what we did, the moves are all on my website. They can see that. Okay. So we go to the third casino. And same thing, I give them the 100 pounds, we go in the casino, everything's cool, we get paid. And now we're thinking about calling it a night, because now it's like, you know, it's getting late, it's about 1 o'clock in the morning. So we say, all right, let's do one more. Just one more. I mean, it's not that I had a feeling that something was going to happen on the fourth move, but something happened on the fourth move. So we're in the fourth casino, and we're setting up to do the move. We're just about ready to do the move, and a guy taps me on the shoulder. I turn around, and I immediately knew it was a high-up person in the casino. He was well-dressed, well-spoken, and he says to me, Mr. Martinez? I said, yes. You know, I almost forgot my name, but I said yes. He says, I'm sorry. You're going to have to come with me, and you're going to have to leave the casino immediately. And I said, why? What happened? He said, I'm sorry. Just take all your chips. We're going to cash you out. And you're going to just have to leave the casino immediately. And our driver will take you anywhere you want to go in London, but you must leave the casino. So I'm like, wow, what happened? I mean, because also one thing I should mention is that London casinos have the best inter-casino communication in the world. That means if something happens in one casino, and this was even back then, if something happens in one casino, all the casinos in London knew about it 20 minutes later. I mean, they would just get on the phones at the time, the fax machines, whatever they had, and they alerted all the casinos. And we have our own internal surveillance and security. And we knew that when we left all three previous casinos, everything was spotless. They had no idea what hit them. So I could not figure out what the hell was going on. Why was this? And the guy, by the way, was the casino, the president of the casino. He identified himself as soon as he approached me. So what was the president of the casino throwing me out of the casino for when I knew everything was spotless, right? So we had an emergency meeting place for when this stuff happens. We immediately, when we leave the casino, we go to an emergency meeting place, which was a cafe. Now, my three buddies who were in the casino with me, now I didn't see them get escorted out or anything like that. And I also didn't see them when I was walking through the casino being escorted by the president on my way out the door. So I don't know what the hell happened to them. So I go to the emergency meeting place, and two of them are already sitting there. Two of my buddies are already sitting there. And I go, what happened? And they tell me the same exact thing happened to them. It's like Agatha Christie, 12 Little Indians, what is it called? 12 Little Indians, or whatever it's called, that story, right? And now we're waiting for the fourth guy, and now the fourth guy walks in, right? So all four of us are sitting in this cafe, and this is the same cafe where we had the meeting with the cab driver, and we told him if we get lost or separated to come back to this particular cafe. So now the four of us are sitting at the cafe wondering, what the hell happened? You know, what happened? You know, we were all sure that there was no heat on us, but they made all four of us, obviously, because we're all guests of the cab driver, and they threw us all out of the casino. And they gave a ride to all four of us to the same part of London where the cafe was. And we didn't have the cab driver go right to the cafe because that would be stupid. We just had the cab driver drop us in the, you know, each one of us had the cab driver drop us in the vicinity of that cafe. So here we are. We're wondering what's going on. It's 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. We're waiting for the cab driver to show up. Maybe he knows something, right? Now it's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. The coffee shop closes. no cabbie, right? We don't know what the hell's going on, right? So finally, we go back to the hotel, and like we're trying to figure it out. And finally, you know, we each go to our rooms, and I fall asleep. At about 7 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings, and I pick up the phone, and it's the cabbie. I go, where the hell are you? Where? He goes, oh, I'm sorry, mate. I had a little problem. I'm down here in the pokey. You guys call jail pokey in London? Is it the pokey, or you just say the? What do you say for jail?
Pokey has been used, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So yes, I'm here in the pokey. I had a little problem. I goes, what do you mean you had a little problem? And I said, he said, well, I'll tell you about it, man. You got to come down here and bail me out. You know, so. So I said, "Holy shit!" So I call up my three buddies in the hotel, and I say, "Yeah, it was the cabbie. He just called me. He's in jail. I gotta go bail him out, right?" So, I go bail him out, and it turns out, right? Ready for this? When we were in the fourth casino, it was a very, very beautiful casino filled with, you know, wealthy people, high rollers, everybody, and. And it turned out there was an Arab sheik gambling in the casino. Sheik or sheikh? I don't know how you guys say it. There was an Arab sheik gambling in the casino with his wife. He was gambling, like playing roulette and punto banco on the big tables. And his wife was playing five pound blackjack, you know, small stakes blackjack. So the cabbie was sitting next to the Arab sheik's wife at the table. And he was picking five pound chips from her. Like when she would go out and make the bet, her bets, he would reach into her pile of chips and he was stealing $5 chips from her. And he got caught, right? So can you imagine this? He blew our whole, we would have made 150,000 pounds on that trip, and he blew it because he was stealing 5 pound chips from the Arab sheik's wife. And when I found out about this, I said, man, you asshole, what are you? You're a damn thief. you're a thief. It was just amazing that happened. You know, it's.
I had no idea where that story was going to go. It could have literally gone anywhere. But as soon as you said he was sat next to the sheik's wife, I'm like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I mean, of all things you plan for, right? We had of all we went through to get him, to get somebody to join, you know, join the club, get us in the casino, and the work we had to do these moves in these are the toughest casinos to beat in the whole world, and everything was going much better than we could have dreamed of. We had three 10,000 pound payoffs, right? At the time, that's like $75,000 at the time. And it was unlimited. I don't know how many more we could have done. Another 5, 7, or 8 more, you know, until finally word gets around that somebody's doing something, right? And the last thing that you could possibly imagine is that the guy that signed us into the casinos was going to steal five pound chips from an Arab sheik's wife and blew the whole thing.
That's the way life is.
Yeah. There's a whole chapter of that in my book, American Roulette in the States, it's called, and in the UK it's called the Great Casino Heist. There's a whole chapter on that story. I mean, it's much more. It goes into a little more detail and everything, but it's one of the most amazing things that ever happened to me. And you know, when you do this kind of thing for a living, when you know, I did this 25 years. I casino skirted or casino trotted the world for 25 years. You know, that's longer, way longer than anyone in history that I know of. And a lot of unbelievable things happen. And you know, there's a lot of them, you know, they're in my books, but this is one of the best ones.
What made you turn to the dark side then? What made you turn from the dark side?
Well, we might as well talk about quickly how I got into the dark side anyway, because that's another great story in itself.
Okay. You know,
when I was a kid, this is a little before your guys' time. I don't know, in the UK, do the kids, like, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, is there such thing as like soccer player cards where you buy, you know, it's like little trading cards for each player that you collect?
Yeah, they're a little bit different these days, but back in the day, you get a little stick of gum with them.
Right, there you go. Okay, in the States, it was the same thing with baseball cards and football cards. So when I was like 8, 9 years old, all the kids collected baseball cards. And what you would do, there was a game, a flipping card game, where you won the cards, you won more cards, or you lost more cards. So it was like gambling. And it, you know, like the cards were like playing cards, casino playing cards, and they had colors to it. So I'm sure you've heard of the expression "dealing seconds," where people, dealers cheat in poker games to keep a preferred card or give a bad card to somebody else. And I realized that in one of these flipping baseball card games, one of the kids was cheating me, but I didn't realize it until he cheated me out of my whole collection. Okay, I lost like thousands of baseball cards to him. And you know, when you're 8 years old, at least when I was 8 years old, like that was my whole life. So that was my introduction into cheating. I became a victim. And then as I went through high school, 15, 16, I started to like, revenge isn't the right word, but I decided to get my money back from people like who were hanging out with me when I was a kid, who I thought, you know, were involved in this baseball card flipping scam. So if you're in my book, I talk about the scams that I did, the childhood and adolescent scams that I did. And that led to my becoming a gambler. And I became, when I was 19 years old, I was not even old enough to legally gamble in casinos in Las Vegas. I won like 30 or 40,000 dollars at the racetrack, at the horse racetrack. And I was really incredibly lucky, and I took the money, I threw it in the trunk of my car, and I bought a new Mustang. I put the money in my car, drove it right out to Vegas, and I wasn't old enough to even gamble. But I knew some names, because in those days, Vegas was different. There were still a lot of mob people in there, and I happened to know some names from New York. So they didn't even care. They let me gamble, and I took the $40,000. I ran it up to $100,000 playing Punto Banco, or Baccarat as it's known in the United States. And I ended up losing the money, all of it. And then I had to sell the car to get a last couple of thousand dollars. I sold the car. I lost that money. I ended up in the street, nothing to eat. I lived in the street for 3 weeks, you know, going into restaurants and not paying. It's a whole long story. But anyway, that's how I ended up in Vegas. And finally, I was literally dying out, being homeless in Las Vegas in Fahrenheit, it's 115 degrees, you know, in the desert. I was literally dying from the heat and everything. And, you know, that would be like 40. Oh, wait. In the UK, they use degrees. They use Fahrenheit too, right? If I remember right, or is it Celsius?
We use Celsius, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it's like 45 degrees Celsius, right? That I was in the, you know, street. And finally, I got myself out of the street. I got a job dealing in a casino. And I was approached by somebody out of the blue who was from New York, where I was from. And, turned out he was a professional casino cheat, and that's how I got involved in the dark side. And now, how did I get from the dark side now to the we'll call it the sunny side or the honest side, whatever. One thing that, you know, I just mentioned to you about, you know, all the amazing things that happen when you do this kind of thing for 25 years, and, you know, like we went everywhere, you know, just about everywhere in the world that had casinos. And at night, you know, like when we were done with the casinos, we would go out to bars and party. Or if we were in the islands during the day, we would, you know, water ski and have fun at the beach. But at nights, we, you know, we party. And one thing about me is I was always a cheater, but not a liar. I was just a cheater. The only lying I basically did was, you know, lying about what to like people inside the casino that I was taking the money from. But like, for instance, people were, if I ran into people in bars, you know, and I knew they weren't casino people, right? And they would ask me like, oh, okay, so, you know, what do you do? I said, oh, I'm a professional casino cheat. And they would go, what? I said, yeah, I'm a professional casino cheat. I go into casinos and I cheat them and to make a living. That's what I do. You asked, I told you. And then I would start to tell stories, like just like I told you guys, I told you one, right? And people would say, wow, that's amazing. You really did that. I can't believe that's true. You know, if that's really true, you should write a book about it. So finally, you know, when I got to be about 44, there was so much heat on me in especially in Las Vegas, because I was doing this move called this Savannah move, which was just an unbelievable move. It was capable of beating videotape. It was capable of beating surveillance, everything. And they knew I was doing it, and they couldn't figure it out. And a lot of people wanted me out of business. You know, I'm not saying anyone was going to kill me or anything like that, but people just wanted me in jail. And I felt the heat. And I remembered that people had always told me, hey, you ought to write a book about that. So here I am, 44. You know, I don't want to push the envelope anymore. I was very lucky. I'm the only known really successful professional casino cheat who's never been caught or arrested or spent any time in jail. The only one. So I took the people up on that. I decided to write a book. I wrote the book, and it got, it was a success within the casino industry and outside the casino industry. And people then in the casino industry who knew about me as a cheater but never knew how I was doing the moves, I told everything in the book. And then that first conference, that game protection conference that I mentioned to you last time we spoke, called the World Game Protection Conference, they contacted me to speak there and present, you know what I did in real time, live. And the audience, or I should say the attendees at that conference, were mostly casino surveillance people and table games people. And they were very interested in me. And then I started to get contacted by them. Would I come down and train their surveillance people and their table games people how to protect themselves from people like me? So that was the transition. And then I became, you know, for the last 17, 18 years now, I've been working as a game protection consultant and trainer to private casinos all around the world. I've done international seminars, including in two of them in London, the last one just back in March 2020. And so that has led to this big conference that I'm doing now in Las Vegas. So that's the arc.
Fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic. So obviously the systems and the moves that you have, it's obviously very tactile. It really works in a land-based environment. Are there equivalents for online games, or is this a land-based only thing?
Well, what we do, you know, what I did is strictly what we call brick and mortar casinos, land-based casinos, right? Online cheating is it's basically hacking. It's basically about the only way to do it. There's been a couple of famous scams. One was called the Ultimate Bet scam, and the other was the Absolute Poker scam. And you know, they were done by the people that were inside that have access to the servers of the website and all that. But online security is getting better. It's gotten a lot better in the last 10-12 years. But you know that there's no way to cheat them, you know, unless you can, you know, interfere with the software or have somebody on the inside.
Got it. And do you miss the old days? Do you miss the buzz?
Oh heck yeah. Oh, no. You know what? I should take that back. I don't miss it in as much as wanting to go out and do it again. Okay. I admit it's the memories. You know, it was by far the greatest period of my life. You know, and I do now, you know, I love telling stories about it. But I do enjoy what I'm doing now. And I often tell, while I'm training casino staffs, and I do tell these type of stories, you know, like a couple of times. One time we had to jump off a boat. We had to jump off a river boat. in the middle of a river because we took some heat on a casino. I mean, I tell these stories, and it turned out, like in that one particular story, in one place where I was telling it, the event happened 30 years before. And there was a person in the room that said, "Oh my God, I remember it. I was there." It was like the person's first or second night in the casino working.
Hilarious.
And this event.
It's like
happened.
A cowboy movie. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's like a
Wild West saloon, jumping off the riverboat. That's amazing. I love it.
And you know what? And people ask me a lot at these conferences or when I'm training. People ask me a lot. Well, so tell me something. Do you regret what you did? Or are you doing this now, teaching us because you're giving back to the community? And I said, hell no. Do I regret what I did? Are you kidding me? It was the best time of my life. I wish I made more than I actually made, right? Because it was, you know, but it's kind of like a natural progression that I would become, a game protection consultant because, you know, like a lot of hackers now work for big corporations to prevent them, you know. What else do I know? I never did anything else in my life. You know, I went from adolescent scams right into casino cheating. I did that for 25 years. I mean, you know, basically the only thing I could do was work in a fast food joint. I'm not putting anyone down who works in a fast food joint. But basically I didn't have any skills to do anything else. So that it's a natural progression.
And in terms of like modern day, so obviously technology's advanced, AI, facial recognition, RFID chips, and you know, so the technology's really moved on since you first started out. But I'm guessing it's that kind of classic arms race. So just the people cheating just get more sophisticated and it becomes more advanced, or is it like some of the old techniques still work well today as they did in the old days?
Okay, that's a great question that I often get asked, but your version of the question is an excellent one. First of all, as the AI and the facial recognition and all that, on the surface, it's as good as it says it is, or the people that sell it say it is. And what I mean by that is, with facial recognition, with the characteristics of a face, the distance between the nose and the eyes and all that, sure, it works great if the person you're trying to identify and compare to a database is cooperating, or is confined into walking into an observance point. Now, there's another word for observance point, but I forgot what they use. In other words, if you're confined in a small width area and you have to look forward and there's a camera right there, yes, they're going to get you. But when you have a busy casinos like in the United States or in the islands, or and there's 40, 50 people walking in at the same time, and you're in a hat and you're in glasses and you're purposely avoiding the camera, I don't think it's that effective. Artificial intelligence there are types of artificial intelligence factors that really help in casinos as far as game protection. They pick up on a lot of things, data patterns, anomalies, stuff like that, that might give surveillance a clue that there's some cheating going on. There's one technology called the RFID, radio frequency identification, which they put a chip in a chip in the chips. What I mean by that is a computer chip in a casino gaming chip, to trace the chips around. And so, for instance, the chip in the chip tells them what the amount is, like says it's a 500-pound chip or a $1,000 chip, whatever it is. And therefore, you can't, like, pass post it. Pass post means make a late bet after the outcome was already been determined. And you can't possibly pass post it because the monitor will tell them what the original chip you bet was, which true. That is all true. But somebody like me, I'll go in and beat the RFID because I'll use surveillance on the people that have to read the monitor. I said surveillance. I'll use psychology. I'll use psychology to convince the people reading the monitor that the monitor made the mistake. And it works fine. You know, it involves setups and all that. I'm not going to get into that now, but the large majority of even, you know, good casino cheats wouldn't know how to go up against RFID technology. But I would, because I always go by one thing, and this is partially going to answer your question when you said about, you know, is it the rat race between the increase in the sophistication of the technology versus the skills of the cheats adapting to it? But I'll say that it always comes down to, there's always people that have to interpret the data and use it to make it effective. So if you have all the greatest artificial intelligence and facial recognition applications in the world, or algorithms and everything, and the people who have to make the judgment on it, they don't know what they're doing, it gets beat. And as a matter of fact, I wrote an article recently for Casino Life magazine, which is a UK publication, by the way. I just wrote it a month or two ago, and the title of the article is "Should Artificial Intelligence Really Be Called Artificial?" And the reason I make that question is because who designs artificial intelligence? Real people, right? So, mm-hmm. So you know, and I go on for 1,500 words what I mean by that. But you know, to encapsulate it, it's just that the good, the really top casino cheats will stay right there with the artificial intelligence and all the other high technology. I don't care how good that technology is. It will get beat by some people.
I've read, there's a famous computer hacker called Kevin Mitnick. And I read his book many years ago. Mm-hmm. And obviously he's got the technical skills.
I got to interrupt you right
now.
Go
for it.
Kevin Mitnick emailed me in 2010 out of the blue, because he was doing a presentation at a game protection conference, and he didn't know what to do or what to say. And I answered him. And the reason I'm telling you this is because I have his email in evidence if I ever get questioned on this. Okay. He had no clue. And he emailed me to ask him what to do. So go ahead. You can go on about Kevin Mitnick. And he knows nothing. He knows nothing about what's going on with technology and casinos.
But sure. But I think there's, because there was this technical background that all the stuff he did, but you know, that was only 50% of it. And it seems very similar to what you're saying. The other 50% is what he calls social engineering. So it was managing the people.
He's right about that. Yeah.
And that sounds like you're it sounds like you're saying something very similar, where it's kind of like, look, I'll figure out the RFID and I'll work with it, but then there's somebody's got to interpret that information and I'll work them as well, because that's the weak link in the chain, right? So it's that hard and soft skills used in combination is actually the magic.
As much as I, you know, don't think he's that knowledgeable about casinos, well, he is certainly right about that. Because that goes to any industry, any.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't talking about casinos, but just in terms of him in like when his computer hacking, and he hacked into the NSA and all the kind of crazy stuff he did, but he did most of it over the phone, actually talking to people rather than just the technical bit.
Right.
So he used both. Both sets of skills, hard and soft skills.
Yeah. As great as my casino cheating stuff was, it still can be reduced to a simple con where you make people believe what you want them to believe or what they need to believe. It all comes down to that, no matter how sophisticated it is.
Love it. And then just my final fun Kevin Mitnick story is his heavy. You never met him, so you never got his business card.
No.
So he's got this famous. He's got this famous business card that's metallic, but it's actually.
Does it have anything to do with South America or Colombia or on that card?
No, it's a lock. Okay. It's a lock picking set. So yeah, you can use it. Yeah, it's really cool. It sells for a fortune now at this point.
Well, have you already had him on your show, or you should get him on your show?
We should try.
He loves all publicity, so
I'm sure he does. This is fantastic. I
have to edit this at some point. just for because of libel laws and slander. No, I'm just kidding.
No, well, if you broadcast, you can broadcast the part about Kevin Mitnick. Okay, you don't have to say that I said he doesn't know anything, but you about casinos. But you can certainly put the thing that he sent me an email. I'll send you if you need it. I'll send you a copy of that email.
Richard, I don't cut anything out.
Well, I don't know. You guys could be liable for saying
this
something.
This bit's staying in as well.
Okay, they can try. Okay. They can try and find me. I don't worry about that.
You know what? You two guys sound like my kind of guys. I was telling you about the journalist from FHM magazine, Piers Hurnu, who was sent by the magazine to interview me in 2005 for a 3-day gig in Vegas, so they could see like what it was all about. And then Piers turned out to be so interested, he started to try to cheat himself. He became a member. I think he got barred from London casinos trying to cheat himself. But anyway, you two guys, if I could turn the clock back 30 years and we were about the same age, I think maybe you two guys would be with me on this side of the microphone talking about it.
I couldn't possibly comment.
I definitely can, and I definitely would, because I love this.
Well, I love the hard way of making it. Well, listen, man, the Irish guys, like I have plenty of experience with them. The Irish guys, they ain't scared of shit. I know that.
And me being English, I can just convince anybody of any old bullshit. Listen, I've got a quick question for you, Richard. You've been around the world to casinos. What casinos really stand out for you? What are your favorites?
Okay.
Not necessarily in terms of how much you took.
I absolutely am not taking it that way. Okay, let's get that one out of the way. Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. I wrote at the end of my book. It's right at the end in the epilogue. When I die, please have me buried somewhere on the property of Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, because they gave me so much money and I made millions of dollars there, and I love them, and I just want to spend my eternity at Caesar's Palace, Las Vegas. The most impressive casino I ever saw was not the Grand Casino of Monte Carlo, but the one in Baden-Baden. The place is a museum, the most beautiful, gigantic high ceilings. And I was so intimidated by them when I walked in there. I really considered leaving them alone, but of course I did. Of course I didn't. But it was just a tremendous, awe-inspiring casino. It looked like the Louvre in Paris. I mean, it just put the Monte Carlo casino to shame.
Wow.
A few other ones I'll mention are, I always loved the casino on the French Riviera and a bunch of them there. There's a casino in London that's just tremendous. I never cheated it because it's relatively new, but I did my second game protection seminar there. It's called the Hippodrome, and the owner is a guy named
Simon Thomas.
Yeah, great. Simon Thomas is the best casino CEO I've ever met. I mean, he actually came to my seminar. Can you believe that guy actually came to my London seminar? He's a great guy, and he's the one who gave me the permission to do my seminar in his casino. And the place is, have you ever been in there?
Yeah, lots and lots of times.
The place is fabulous. I mean, it's just fabulous. As a matter of fact, if you go on my website and you look at my game protection conference program and you see the days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and you look at the photos, those are taken inside when I was doing the conference, my seminar in the Hippodrome Casino. I mean, they got a different level with different themes. And they even got a little part of a floor about American barbershops, the history of American barbershops. The guy did a tremendous, tremendous job. Yeah, I hope he listens to this.
Interestingly, he was on the podcast that I had before this, which was called The Bruford Files.
He was on it. So you spoke to him.
Yeah. I did a bunch of articles on the Hippodrome Casino while they were converting it. So I first met Simon about 2 years before the casino opened. We recently had the guy who is their head of interactive on about the app they've just launched. And
that's great. And listen to this. I left this out. One of the greatest things about the Hippodrome, if you've ever been in the men's room and you're taking a leak and you're looking out on Leicester Square, right?
Yeah.
There's a sign right next to the urinals. It says, "Don't worry, they can't see you."
The only thing that was disappointing to me about the casino was that nobody can watch me peeing.
Yeah, wow. What a place, though, really. Those are my favorite casinos, you know.
I take on board what you're saying. I am a big fan of the Hippodrome as well, and I think it's very telling that during the ICE exhibition in London, if you go into the Hippodrome in any evening, it is wall-to-wall casino industry, because that's where they go to hang out, because it does what it does extremely well.
No, I don't know Simon, you know, well. You probably know him better than I do, you know, but I have met him twice, and you know, like I said, he was at my London seminars, and even when I asked volunteers to participate, because I needed volunteers to help me, demonstrate the scams, and he was right there, and he and the journalist Piers Hurnu that I mentioned to you from FHM, who ended up trying to go cheat the casinos in London, but this is before the Hippodrome was in existence. Him and Simon were getting along real well, and it was just. He's just the nicest guy, and like he's like humble. You know what I mean? He's like, obviously he's a very wealthy guy, but he's like a regular guy.
I've never heard him called humble before. I'm gonna have to get him to listen to this.
Yeah, well, at least he treats people, you know, like they're his equals.
Speaks to me. I mean, that's all I ask. Generally.
Yeah, you're lucky knowing you, right?
Yeah, seriously, yeah. I always think it could go either way when I actually speak to people. Richard, I thank you so much for joining us today. It's been eye-opening. It's been illuminating.
Yeah, I like this one. This one was different, man. This one was different. Get a UK guy with an Irish guy who knows where his roots go back in the 70s. We don't know, right? But
all we need is a Scotsman and a Welshman, and we've got a bad joke, you know. Richard, while we're talking, where are you from?
Originally France. Believe it or not, I came to the United States when I was 5, and then. New York, obviously, you could probably hear the New York in my accent, right?
Yeah, there's a little bit in the back of my mind. I just keep saying, forget about it.
Not yet. That's
New Jersey, isn't it?
Yeah, that's New Jersey. Yeah, Sopranos.
Yeah, thank you.
And by the way, another real, real quick story, and I'll let you guys go. This is a quick one.
Okay.
The man that is emceeing my conference, this guy by the name of Paul Mollo, M-O-L-L-O. He's an Italian man from New Jersey. And this guy, I never met him. Okay. I saw him on an interview. He was on an interview and he was speaking. And in the interview, they just mentioned like the mob. They just mentioned it, right? It was a casino industry interview and they just mentioned it. And I'm looking at Paul Mollo and I'm saying, I don't know this guy. I got to get him at my conference, right? I said to myself, he's just out of the Sopranos. So I found him on LinkedIn and I sent him he had heard of me before, which was good. And I sent him an email and I said, hey, Paul, I just saw you on that show. And man, you're right out of the Sopranos. I got to have you at my show, right? And he emailed me back 5 minutes later. He said, well, that's funny. I was in The Sopranos 3 times as a guest actor.
Brilliant.
Okay. And if you looked at my LinkedIn account, because I know, John, we're connected, you will see my post today about Paul Mollo with a picture of The Sopranos on it.
I saw that. And I just messaged Fenton to say, I've connected with Paul today, or I tried connecting with Paul today because I thought, he'd be another good guest, yeah.
Yeah, that's a small world, but he's going to be the guy, and the guy's a great storyteller. I mean, I could just tell all this. I just listened to him on an interview, and I could see how good this guy was. And it turns out he's hugely popular, and it's just great. I'm so happy that I have him there.